Today's Tay Show will be on case 129 in the collection of koans known as Entangling Vines. Case 129 is entitled Dong Shan and the Earth Spirit. Though Dong Shan, Liang Ji, spent his life at the temple, the local earth spirit, search though he might, couldn't locate so much as a trace of him. Then one day, Dong Shan noticed some grain scattered on the ground in front of the kitchen. He became angry and he said, "How could community supplies be wasted like that?" At that moment, the earth spirit finally detected him and paid him homage. So thank you all very much for your deep sitting this morning. That long morning sit, the three periods of sitting without a break, is a challenge. It's a challenge, there's no question. But if you keep at it, I think you will agree that might be the deepest sit you have all day. It's the most wonderful opportunity to really focus deeply on your koan or on mu or on your breath. And it's really just, it's a wonderful opportunity. And everybody did such a great job. The Zendo was so still. So it was wonderful. Thank you. And thank you for coming to Sesshin. It's so wonderful to see you here. Sesshin is, as I said last night, it's like nothing else in the world. This is an opportunity for people to come and cultivate awakened mind, right, together in a focused way. And there's nothing else in our society. At one time, there was, more attention to this in the world. In Tibet, something like, a fifth of all the people in Tibet were in monasteries before the Cultural Revolution. And in China also, there was this system of public temples, just like public schools. Americans put a lot of emphasis on education. And we have public schools, and you can go, you can move from, Hoboken to, Plainfield, or from Plainfield to, Durham, North Carolina, and you can go to the local school where you live and go to school. And that's because this is something we value so highly. And in ancient China, they had a system of public temples. And if you were a man or a woman and you wanted to pursue awakening, and you had basically become a home leaver, a monk or a nun, you could go to any temple, any public temple in China, and present your papers. You had to have your ordination papers with you. And somebody would look at your papers and say, "Okay, go to the bunkhouse. You go to weekly, and you have room, whatever the great swamp room or whatever, be in the Zen hall at 5 a.m. and breakfast is at 8, and you are in the groove, right?" So they made it easy to practice Zen, and that was because they really understood this thing we call enlightenment. They understood how important that is. And you understand how important that is because you've come here. And to be at Sesshin is to be like a monk or a nun for a couple days, right? You're basically, we're not eating any meat. We're abstaining from other kinds of activities. you know, you're getting up early in the morning and sitting through the day. And so this is like two days or 5 days or 7 days at the monastery. And you know, coming here, even though you we all live in the world, you know, we all have jobs, we rent a place where we live, or we own a home and pay very heavy taxes, you know, but nevertheless, for this period of time, we really are home leavers. You know, to be a home leaver is a really interesting proposition. You know, the Buddha, according to the Buddha's story, he, as I mentioned yesterday, you know, he was in Buddhist legend or Buddhist lore, he is supposed to be the son of a king, but, you know, historians said the country where the Buddha lived didn't have a king. You know, they had a parliament building, and in fact, in some of the early Buddhist sutras, the Buddha was actually invited to go to the parliament and deliver a lecture, yes. And he was very old, and he, halfway through his talk, he said, "Would you mind if I leaned up against this pillar because my back is hurting so much?" You know, so if your back is hurting you, the Buddha's back hurt too, his legs hurt too, you know. So he wasn't a son of a king, but he was probably the son of the prime minister or public figure. And he was, raised to be a public figure. He had an elite education, and he was trained in horsemanship and archery and military science, yeah, because that's what it meant to be a leader, and government, you know, and public speaking. He was very well spoken, and then he became aware of some problems with, you know, ordinary reality. You know, in the Buddhist legend, it said his father, the king, had kept from him all knowledge of sickness, old age, and death. And somehow he got out of the palace, and he was riding his horse, and he saw an old man. And he said, "What the hell is that? And look at that gray hair, oh my gosh." And then he saw somebody who was very ill, and then he saw a corpse. Right now, you know, this is so, if you don't mind my saying so, I find this very unconvincing, you know. I think he knew about these things. There's another story in the Pali Sutras that I like much more, and I think it's more to the point. When the Buddha, this one seems real to me, you know, some of the stuff in the Pali Sutras really seems real, seems like these are the Buddha's voice, right? It's called Buddha Vakana, the very words of the Buddha, right? And some historians and scholars say, you know, some of the early sutras are not the Buddha's voice, but there's like a core of them that there are many reasons to think they're legitimate. You know, they're the real, after the Buddha died, all the Sangha, the monastic community, got together, and they pieced together all the Buddha's teachings and committed them to memory. And they would have sessions where everybody would come and they would recite the sutra they had committed to memory. That's why so many of the sutras start out, "Thus have I heard." So it's always like, "Thus have I heard the Buddha was in such and such a place with so-and-so, and so-and-so asked him this question, and here's what he said." And they had, you know, like teams, you know, a couple monks or nuns would, you know, basically have committed their sutras to memory, and they would compare to make sure there were no distortions. And then about 300 years later or 200 years later, a lot of this got written down. But anyway, the story that I think is real, the Buddha said at one point, when I was a boy, I was out in the fields with my father. See, and he said, and I saw in the plowed fields that earthworms had come to the surface. And these crows landed and were eating them, you know, eating them. And he said the worms were trying to get away. And I think that's so powerful. I mean, you might say, yeah, of course, you know, birds eat worms. But you know, he looked at this and it was a stunning moment of insight, right? I think for him. You know, basically, he probably had grown up in a pretty affluent, by 600 BC standards, pretty affluent family. His father was prosperous. His mother was supposed to be quite attractive, his mother. And he was surrounded by a loving family, right? And, you know, but he went out in the field and he looked and he saw, and he said the worms were trying to get away and the crows were killing them. And he said, I thought to myself, what kind of world is this? Where have I, in what world have I been born? So I think that's a really, really powerful story. You know, when I was telling my nephew about this story, and he said, well, Kurt, he said, that's Uncle Kurt. He said, that's just the circle of life. And I agree, I think, but we call it the circle of life. We don't call it the circle of life and death, right? Because we repress the death part. And the Buddha was really troubled by this. You know, in other words, I myself go onto Facebook. If you're on Facebook, you know I'm on Facebook. And I have just discovered Reels, you know, which are fascinating and addictive, right? And they have like nature reels. And I'll be watching this nature reel and they have these Tibetan snow leopards and they have these sheep. Really like the snow leopard pursuing the sheep and the sheep trying heroically to get away. I have to say, I love snow leopards, and I kind of root for the snow leopard. My wife, I say, look at this. She says, no, I don't. And actually, I really respect it, because she's rooting for the mountain goat, right? And there's a moment when the snow leopard gets the mountain goat, and it's. You could say it's the circle of life, but it also has a kind of tragic dimension, right? Because that goat is maybe has young, that goat is doing her best, right? To be, she's the best goat she can be. And the leopard is the best, maybe that mother leopard is the best leopard she can be. And you know, there's this tragic moment where one of them, the mother leopard, is going to go home hungry to her starving cubs. Or, you know, basically the mother goat is not going to go home, right? And one or the other outcomes. And they're both sort of like, to my mind, they're unsatisfactory outcomes, right? So basically, you know, the Buddha in this passage says, you know, I thought I was, you know, the world was a great place, right? But then one day I was out in the field and I thought, what the hell? What kind of reality is this, right? And I think that there's a deep insight to this, right? A deep insight to this. And we might not be ready to receive that insight, but I think this insight started the Buddha on the path to awakening. It's like, you know, if you identify with the snow leopard, you know, you don't see the suffering of the mountain goat. You don't see the courage and the heroism of the mountain goat. And if you identify with the mountain goat, you don't see the courage and the heroism of that mother snow leopard, right? And we want to pick a winner and a loser, right? We want to say, well, this is what had to happen, you know. But when we do that, when we pick the winner and the loser, you know, we're looking past the contradiction in reality. Like, there's a lot of contradiction in reality. And I think the Buddha's life was really struggling with this question, right? You know, we want to say that basically the world is a good place to be. And I have to say, my sister-in-law is probably going to die any day now. So when I looked at my text message to see if my sister-in-law was still alive, and there was a text message from my sister saying, "Trump convicted, yay!" Right? And it's like, ah, the universe, it's a good universe. Or at least that's my political view. So we want to say that the world is a good place, and that, you know, bad things just happen. But, you know, actually the Buddha said, you know, the Buddha actually said, don't think like that. Isn't that interesting? The Buddha actually said, don't think like that. He said, you know, because, you know, then you wind up seeing only half the picture, right? It's like you wind up repressing a lot of things. You wind up ignoring a lot of suffering so that, you know, you can have a happy view. You can have a happy view of things. And he said, you know, we need to be aware that to be alive involves a lot of suffering. The first noble truth is to be alive is to undergo a lot of suffering. And I've had so many people tell me, oh, that is very pessimistic, right? But you know, when I think if we're honest, you know, a lot of life, there is joy, there's definitely joy, but there's a lot of suffering. And, you know, the Buddha felt that if we don't look at the suffering, we get a very distorted picture of the world. You know, when we are trying to be happy and we put our own happiness front and center, you know, a lot of the times we don't think about how our actions affect others. Because, you know, we're very invested in our own happiness and we don't want to look at, like, the ways in which the things we do may affect others in a negative way. This is, like, very common. So all of this sounds kind of bleak, right? And it sounds like a very, very dark view of reality, right? The Buddha starts from this place, right? And he says, I'm not going to look away from the suffering. I'm not going to try to have a happy personal life. I'm going to try to see behind happiness and sorrow and see if there's something deeper than that, right? And that's really what Buddhism is all about. You know, it's actually, you know, if we practice Zen so that we can be happy, that's a pretty good motive. But a deeper motive would be practicing Zen so we can be awake. You know, so it's possible to imagine somebody who, like, is an embezzler, like an embezzler, who practices Zazen because he feels anxious when he's swindling people. He says, I've been siphoning off all this money and I put it in these accounts and I can't sleep. So I'm doing Zazen and it works like a charm, right? You know. And, you know, that wasn't what the Buddha taught, right? So the Buddha said, you know, instead, you know, it's possible to go through life and say, I want to maximize my happiness and minimize my suffering. And, you know, I want to play the system so that I get the maximum happiness and the minimum of suffering. And the Buddha says that if you do that, you know, not only are you not going to escape from suffering, right? In fact, you're not. But he said also you're going to be indifferent to the suffering of others, you know. So he said there must be another way to live, there must be another way to live. And he set on his path towards enlightenment. And, you know, after a great deal of effort, he had this great awakening experience. In which he basically said, there is no self, really, the self doesn't exist, but, and in fact, you know, there's something deeper than life and death, existence and non-existence. And he called it the unborn, or the deathless. He said, when he had his awakening experience, he said, I have encountered the deathless, right? And the Buddha, it's interesting, you know, the Buddha did not, the Buddha did not go up into heaven after his awakening and disappear from the face of the earth. He continued to be in the world. He continued to be active. In fact, he was like super active, right? We know a lot about the Buddha's personal life from the early sutras. He got up very early. He would meditate with the monks and nuns. He would go begging for his food, and you weren't allowed to eat after noon. So you could eat from sun up until noon, and then that was it, you know. And in the afternoon, he was often teaching people meditation. And in the Pali Sutras, all these people would come. One of the Buddha's best friend was a very prosperous businessman, but really one of the richest men in Buddhist India. And he donated lots of land to the Buddha. The basically political leaders would come to see him. And you know, they said that basically he was, you know, according to the records, people who met him said, you know, it was like being in the presence of somebody who is unconditionally compassionate. Right? Unconditionally compassionate. You know, so if two people are having an argument, basically they might, you know, one person says, you know, I have the deed to this land and it's mine. And another person said, but, you know, that's always been in my tribal land. That's always been tribal land that my people have lived on for 1,000 years. You know, and they start arguing, you know, when people would go to the Buddha, you know, he didn't go, okay, the law says this, these are your rights, these are not your rights, you know, let's split the difference, people who met the Buddha were overwhelmed with compassion, you know, and there's a lot of times where people just say, you know, you can have the goddamn land, right? It's like, when people are trying to protect themselves from suffering or preserve their own happiness, they lose sight of the bigger picture. And when they would be in the presence of the Buddha, it's like this bigger world, and you know, it's like, oh, I forgot about compassion. You know, I was so concerned with being happy, I forgot about compassion. I was so concerned with, you know, getting that property, developing that property, so you know, my grandkids would have a legacy, that I forgot about this, you know, what about the suffering of this other guy? You know, and there are many stories in the Pali Sutras where you know, basically people would, it wasn't just like having somebody like King Solomon, you know, offering judgment, a wise judgment. What was the defining characteristic of the Buddha was this, that his presence was this powerful, like overwhelming sense of compassion. And it's like, we think these things are so important. People would think these things are so important. And then in the presence of the Buddha, they realize these are not important. You know, these are everything we value is here today, gone tomorrow. You know? And you know, we're so caught up in the small picture, because it all seems so real to us, that we lose track of the larger picture. So, you know, it might sound at first like what I'm saying is really kind of brutal, right? Like, you know, suffering's an element of life. You know, what's wrong with like maximizing my happiness and minimizing my suffering? That's like a very basic idea in Western culture, right? And the Buddha comes along and says, you know, trying to do that, you will never escape your unhappiness. You know, because you know, they are, it's because those two things go together, because they're both about me, right? They're both about me, right? So, you know, even though it sounds terrible to say, you know, the Buddha kind of says that, you know, pursuing your own happiness is self-centered. He does. And he also says it's an invitation to suffering down the road, because suffering is caused by clinging to the self. See? And you could, this might create like a kind of panic, like, oh my God, so I'm destined to a life of suffering. Is that what Buddha's teaching? You know, a life of suffering. If that were true, there wouldn't be a Buddhism. You know, the temples would have been emptied out. You know, but you know, it sounds like a tough proposition, right? Don't try to be happy. Do you want me to suffer all the time? And that's not what the Buddha's saying. You know, what he was saying was, look, you know, gain and loss, right and wrong, such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. You know, my father-in-law worked so hard to retire, and he, you know, had a 401k, and he had made all these sacrifices, right? And at the end of his life, you may remember in 2007 and 8, we had a massive collapse of the stock market. And my father-in-law lost like half of his life savings in a year. It's one of the reasons he came to live with me and my wife. You know, he had done everything right, but it was uncontrollable. You know, he had done everything. He went to financial advisors. They said, do this. And, you know, basically, half of it was wiped out. So, you know, we don't like to think in these terms, but, you know, life is very complicated, and it's not really controllable. And, you know, we might be thinking, if I do Zazen, I'll have more control over my life. But actually, that's not true. You know, that's not true. What Buddhism can offer is not a path to happiness, even though it's often advertised that way. And it's not a path to, you know, basically winning at any game, including 401ks. And I have one too, and I hope the stock market doesn't crash. But you know, basically, what Buddhism is about is there's a bigger picture. There's a bigger picture. And things are going to unfold as they're going to unfold. And, you know, to respond to suffering by getting angry just causes more suffering. To respond to unexpected events by being fearful just causes more fear. You know, liberation is about stepping outside of this whole system. Of, you know, the whole system, even if it's just for an hour, stepping outside of the whole system and seeing the bigger picture. You know, in the scheme of things, it's not that, you know, some of the things we worry about are not that important. And the Buddha says, I have gone to a place where there's no birth and no death, and I can tell you, the only thing that really matters is compassion. It's the only thing that really matters. Okay. So now I'll get to the koan. So finally getting to the koan. You know, there's a great Zen master named Dongshan Liangzhi, who spent his life at the temple, and the earth spirit searches for him and can't find him. Why can't the earth spirit find him? Because he has no attachments. He has no attachments for or against anything. See, he dwells in non-attached compassion all the time. You know, when the earth spirit looks for him, he can't find him. He's saying, where do I'm the earth spirit in this area, and I'm looking for fear. Let me see if I can find any fear. Nope. No fear here. Okay, and then he goes over to the next place. My God, there's fear, plenty of fear here. He sees where's envy? I can't find any envy. Where's selfishness? I can't find any selfishness here. So he can find it everywhere, but not at the temple, see. One day he's going out of the temple and he sees that some careless cooks in the temple have thrown some rice on the ground, and he gets angry. And his motivation is a good one, right? His motivation is a good one. He's worried about the, you know, wasting food is bad for the whole community. But in that moment of, like, getting angry, he becomes visible to the earth spirit. It's like, see, he's lost track of the bigger picture. He's lost track of the bigger picture. This is a person who's really a saint, right? And so then the earth spirit honors him for his saintliness. But saints are saints are inferior to Buddhas, because saints dwell in the realm of virtue and vice, good and bad, and Buddhas are beyond virtue and vice, good and bad. So, you know, there's another story, a really interesting story. There was a Zen master who was not completely awake, and he was so holy that the birds would bring him food every morning. Can you imagine? We had such beautiful birds. I don't know if you heard that jay this morning. I love blue jays. I love the trilling of blue jays. The blue jays were singing, and this saintly monk living in a cave was so good and so pure that the birds would bring in their beaks food for him to eat. And then, according to the story, he had his daikensho, he had his great awakening, and the birds stopped coming. It's like, you know, what's that all about? But you know, even, you know, it's good to be good, but compassion is beyond good and bad, right and wrong, gain and loss, and so on. See, so you know, this is the teaching. And when we come to Sesshin, and we do Sesshin, and we do hours and hours of Zazen, you know, I mean, when I started sitting 50 years ago, 48 years ago, my goal was to get out of my suffering. And, you know, basically I didn't even imagine being happy. I just didn't want to be suffering so much. But you know, I think that, you know, Buddhism is not about maximizing your happiness and minimizing your suffering. It's not about being a better English professor or accountant. It's those are important things, but there's a bigger perspective. Compassion doesn't take sides. It doesn't have winners and losers. You know, compassion is absolutely non-discriminating and infinite in all directions, see. And the Buddha's teaching is that if we act from that place, see, in a way it's like when something happens to us, right, we get involved, we get entangled in it, right? And, you know, and then we're suffering and we're laughing and we're crying and we're mad, and you could say, oh, this is splendid, right? But the Buddha said, actually, there's another way to go through life, right? You know, when there's a way of going through life where you dwell in, you know, basically you dwell in this impartial compassion. You know, all of Zen training is about learning how to dwell in an impartial compassion. And, you know, bad people receive your compassion as well as good people. You know, that was the hallmark of the Buddha. You know, there was a man named Anguimala who was a murderer, and people couldn't believe the Buddha was even talking to him. And, you know, but the Buddha didn't make those discriminations. And actually, you know, Anguimala was a murderer, and he became the Buddha's student, and he achieved a great awakening and became a person of extraordinary loving kindness, right? So you know, and some of the monks in the community were really mad about this. They said, he's killed people, you know, he shouldn't have enlightenment. He should have to burn off his bad karma, you know, for 30 lifetimes. What a raw deal for us, you know. But they were making discriminations, right? It's like this idea of absolutely non-discriminating compassion. And my experience is that, you know, I'm rarely capable of reaching this mark. But when I do, things are so, it's like I become a bodhisattva. I become a being, an enlightened being at work in the world. You know, I'm an English professor, and I've had, you know, like 45 students in my two classes this semester. And, you know, I have students who I think are not telling me the truth. You know, I think they're lying to me. You know, I don't think they're doing their work. You know, I think they're shiftless ne'er-do-wells, you know. But if I act from that place, what do you expect to happen, right? And I might say, well, they deserve a kick in the ass, you know. But, you know, I swear to you, when I have not acted from that place, when I treat everybody as worthy of respect, right, if I, you know, I give the compassion vibe, you know, I feel it. You know, it's like, I see this person suffering. I see this person suffering. You know, I understand, you know, of course she's cynical about education. Who wouldn't be? Of course she's gonna use AI to write her paper. You know, what I do in that case, I have computer programs that detect AI. And I'll just meet with the student, and I'll say, I think AI wrote this. You know, here's three different programs that say it. And the student, you know, they'll look at me like in terror, and I'll say, please write a paper in your own voice. I'd really like to know what you have to say. And it's like they can't decide if I'm a fool or not, but they actually write a paper that's, you know, pretty good. And, you know, I could respond punitively, you know, with righteous violence, or I could, you know, but actually, you know, it's like life is so short, you know, why not try to be, you know, why not try to be kind, you know? And it's hard, I find it hard to be kind sometimes. I really have to work, and I sit down on my cushion and I realize, you know, I have to let go of my own desire for happiness and avoiding suffering and just put the other person first, you know? And that doesn't mean I don't stick up for my rights sometime, you know? But you can even understand that people causing you pain are acting from pain. The people who cause you to suffer are themselves suffering. You know, once you see this, you know, you're on the road, I think. You know, once we see this, we're all on the road to Buddhahood, really, you know. Which is what we're on. We're on the road to Buddhahood. Though Dongshan Liangzhi spent his life at the temple, the local earth spirit, search though he might, could not locate so much as a trace of him. Then one day, Dongshan noticed some grain scattered on the ground in front of the kitchen. He became angry and said, how could the community supplies be wasted like that? At that moment, the earth spirit finally detected him and paid homage. So he says, you know, he said, you, Dongshan, are a saint. But Dongshan had just fallen from sainthood, he'd fallen out of bodhisattvahood into sainthood for a moment, a temporary lapse. You know, he didn't respond with compassion to these people who made a mistake, you could say. So it's so important to have compassion also for oneself, and please remember that, you know, this is really also about having Zen is also about having compassion for yourself. You know, we're all tangled up in knots. We're all tangled up in our knots. And we've come here to untangle them, and we're going to untangle them one knot at a time, you know. And every time we do that, we're going to feel better. So yes, you know, this is about answering your koan, and yes, it's about being happy. You'll have many, many happy moments. But ultimately, it's about something bigger than answering a koan or bigger than happiness. It's discovering your own, that compassion is who and what you fundamentally are. Your Buddha nature is fundamentally your infinite capacity for compassion. So please keep up the good work.